Hi, hello. We have a fun episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, LeBron James finally made his decision. He is a Philadelphia 76er. Steve and I talk about the ins and outs of the fit, the strengths, potential question marks, all of the fun stuff with the LeBron James conversation. We then shift to the W side. We recap an awesome All-Star weekend, and then we take a peek at some of the most interesting storylines heading into the second half of the season. We had a lot of fun with this episode. We hope you enjoy. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Hello.
We have the brief intro. We do not have a guest, which means it's time to get to business. It's time to get to the biggest news of the weekend on the NBA side. LeBron James has finally made his decision. LeBron James. Not going to Golden State, not returning to Cleveland, not returning to Miami. Again, Minnesota was just out of the picture. I feel like that was a great fit, but it's okay. The Philadelphia 76ers, Steve, land LeBron James, and assuming that he clears waivers later today, will also be landing Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. There's a little bit of bottom of the roster movement necessary there to clear the roster spot. But the bigger news, LeBron James making his decision, signing with the Philadelphia 76ers. So what I'll ask you, Steve, as I was doing media scrums for W All-Star Weekend at the time that this was announced. I'm just like, well, this is fantastic timing. But what was your initial reaction to LeBron making the decision? How surprised were you surprised at all that it was Philadelphia? Just what are some of your initial impressions on the fit in Philly?
Yes, I was surprised. I was shocked. I didn't think I would see LeBron James Philadelphia 76er. I didn't think the process would end up in a scenario where we went from Ben Simmons to Jimmy Butler to Tobias Harris to James Harden to Paul George to LeBron James. I didn't think this would be the thing. We sat there and recorded a podcast early, and I praised the Sixers offseason, and then they added LeBron James, and here we are. And so, number one, that Bob Myers podcast appearance might need to go in the Hall of Fame. But I was stunned. I was stunned, and I think it was clear the talk from LeBron was, hey, it's about happiness, it's about joy, it's about fun. And for one of the greatest players that we've ever seen play the game of basketball, it appears the fun is working to play for a championship and getting a whole different kind of challenge. And like we've seen him do it in Cleveland, we've seen him do it in Miami, we've seen him do it with the Lakers. If he wins one in Philly, that's insane. You got to remember, this is a Sixers team that has been eliminated in the semifinals of the Eastern Conference in 6 of their last 8 playoff appearances. They have not been to the NBA Finals since 2001. They have not won a championship since 1983. And so it's interesting to see just LeBron look at that roster, what they put together, and choose that. And kind of dialing it back, like it's fun to be first. It's fun to react. I always like sitting back and letting things soak in. We did the mandatory LeBron James updates, right? We talked about the team expanding and shrinking. The one team that kind of stuck around, Philadelphia. They were just always just hanging around. And now he's a Sixer. And so I just think there's a shock and awe towards it. How did you absorb it, Nikias? Just starting there before we get to the basketball.
I was a little bit surprised that it ended up being Philadelphia. Mostly because I thought, as he indexed on happiness, there were going to be like more storyline factors that would kind of lean into him making the decision. Whether that is staying closer to home, going to Golden State, finally getting to play with Steph, obviously has the friendship with Draymond Green, et cetera. There are the obvious heartstrings to like starting a career in Cleveland, coming back midway through winning a championship and then ending in Cleveland. There's the Miami thing where he wins multiple championships, is where he really evolves as a player. It leaves on less than ideal terms, but those fences are mended, and now it's like big offseason with Giannis plus LeBron, and you kind of go full circle there. The Philly one, I think it's easy to kind of map out what the positives are, and we're certainly going to get there. That's why we had the weekend to kind of soak this in. But for me, it was like strong starting lineup, has a relationship with Mike Gansey, but like what else is there? Like what is the extra for me? I guess that was part of what I was missing in my analysis of Philly as a spot, because as we did these multiple updates, I had my list of teams. It's like, okay, well, if it's on-court fit, then I have, like, Minnesota. If it's the off-court stuff, it's like, it's Cleveland or Miami. And so Philly always ended up, like, third for me in the list of teams when it came to different categories. And so based on that alone, there was just a baseline level of shock that I had. It was like, okay, well, I just did not have this on the bingo card. I did not consider some of these things heavily enough for Philly to be more of a realistic landing spot in my eyes. But as we've had the weekend to kind of soak in some things, I think it's easy to see why LeBron would look at Tyrese Maxey and Vijay Edgecombe and Jaylen Brown. I think that trade certainly made ways for him during this evaluation process. I think without the Jaylen Brown trade, maybe it's still Philly. I can't completely rule that out. But I will say that certainly helped him turn his head a little bit, like, oh, between Maxey, Brown, and Joel Embiid when healthy, these are three guys that can soak up insane usage and put points on the board and generate pressure on opposing defenses. And I think LeBron wanting the spot to where he can still have his fingerprints on winning without having to be the hand of winning, I think that obviously appealed.
Can we hang right there for a second, what you just said?
Yeah.
Can we just think about the insane sequence of events that kind of took place where the Sixers found the blend of Tyrese Maxey and Joel Embiid and beat the Boston Celtics, and then the Boston Celtics traded them Jaylen Brown, and that ended up being the thing that opened the door for LeBron James to be a Philadelphia 76er. And I think that's like, before we're going to get into it, but I do want to like pause and soak that in. This isn't supposed to happen. It's not supposed to be this. This is not a common scenario. We're not supposed to read the words LeBron James veterans minimum. So you can look at the graphic and see this lineup, and we could poke holes and go back and forth and discuss. This is not a team you're supposed to be able to put together in 2026. So I just want that to be forgotten within this. Like, this is not supposed to happen. So it's tip of the cap there. So how does this work for the Sixers, Nikias? And I think it's going to be very interesting, because I think on one hand, and I don't know why people did the like copy paste usage thing to where all these guys needed the ball. So 150% usage, how's it going to work? Like, I understand what you're saying, but like substitutions exist, different lineups exist. We'll touch on it. But I think when you view this from the Sixers context and you kind of put together like the pieces that they've done, what they've tried to put together, and we saw them kind of evolve and try to go with more movement, more drive and kick, more flow to kind of continue to unlock Tyrese Maxey, but also to unlock Vijay Edgecombe. And that was to kind of give the team a base around Joel Embiid maybe not being there, maybe being there. We then also saw at points during the season, Joel Embiid elevating that team to where they found that combination where, we got pace, we got tempo, we got transition, we got flow. You also have to deal with Joel Embiid. Two-man game with Joel Embiid and Tyrese Maxey. Do you want to switch this? Do you want to double? Do you want to handle this pop? And when we saw that in the playoffs against Boston, real tough decisions you have to make, because, you game planned for Tyrese Maxey. He kind of poked that a little bit, and then Joel Embiid poked at a little things, and now you're in a different type of series. So you now add Jaylen Brown, who, again, second in the NBA last year in drives per game, and you add LeBron on top of that. And so for me, how they build the boat offensively is going to be very important. How do they, what do they do to kind of open things up? LeBron should be able to just handle a lot of things for the Sixers. If you were looking at the Sixers roster and you didn't trust Embiid's passing out of double teams, and you didn't want Tyrese Maxey to be a, as the kids say, pure point guard, and you didn't trust Jaylen Brown's decision-making, getting a facilitator, that is LeBron James, is probably a big deal to kind of fix a lot of things that adds to your half-court package and the ways you can use them. I also think that if you're looking just purely through the Sixers context, did you love Tyrese Maxey having to play 39 minutes a night? Did you love Vijay Edgecombe having to play 38 minutes a night? I think LeBron James helps with that. So I think there's like some sympathy there. But how are they going to try and figure out how much movement do we get? How many post-ups do we get? What kind of tempo do we play with? Like, I think they're going to be better in transition than people anticipate. I think that's something that, like, Embiid's going to trail, and we've seen them kind of set flares for him. That's good. LeBron, we saw last year, okay, cool. I don't have to bring it up every time, so I'll just run. And we know Maxey, Vijay, and Jaylen Brown will push it. So I think there's going to be elements there that are fun. But I think it's going to take time for them to build it out in the half court. But with their personnel, it should be fun. So we'll dive deeper. But what were your initial thoughts with the offensive impact with LeBron in Philly?
Yeah. So I think to bounce off of what you said, Steve, my initial thought was naturally through the LeBron lens, because that's where the announcement came from. And something I said earlier, like I think he looked at Tyrese Maxey, who can do things on and off the ball, and the blend is going to be important, as you alluded to. But Tyrese Maxey can handle heavy duties. Jaylen Brown can handle heavy duties. Joel Embiid, when healthy, can handle heavy duties. And for LeBron James, it's like, okay, cool. This is a situation where I can pick my spots more often. Like, there's already rumblings of he's going to be more of the point guard. Like, he hasn't initiated all but like 1.5 offenses in his NBA career, but we'll leave that alone for now. But he can just kind of be initiator. I could just be an elbow hub, high post hub. I could run pick and rolls and just kind of go. After misses, if I grab the ball, oh, I could just outlet this out to VJ and Tyrese Maxey, and they can just get downhill immediately and score. And then, as you mentioned, Joel Embiid can trail. Oh, LeBron could just kind of stampede into touches now and get some catches on the move, get downhill. And now he's either finishing or kicking out and keeping the chain going that way. So I think LeBron being in the situation to where, again, I can just kind of read the game. If we're playing a team that has a smaller four on me, okay, this might be my game where I score 10 points in the first quarter because I'm just bullying people. Tyrese Maxey has a matchup in this particular night. All right, cool. I'll just be facilitator. Let's get him flowing off of staggers and pin downs, and let's get him attacking. I think that's a great situation for him. And I think for the Sixers, as you already touched on, if you had any kind of passing concerns overall with the roster, it may be unfair to say LeBron completely solves all of them. I think you have to turn the volume down from like 10 to 2 when you have LeBron James in, when he is one of the best playmakers the league has ever seen. So, like, that's where I'm intrigued by. And I think primary question I have before I toss it back to you, Steve, is to the tempo point. Just how fast do they ultimately want to play? I think depending on who is shouldering more of the load offensively, that's going to come to dictate how fast the offense flows overall. But we'll just have to see once games are played what that part is going to look like.
No, I mean, I think that's a sticking point and something we'll kind of see them build, because it's like, okay, what actions are you going to run? And it kind of ties into something that I was thinking about as you were talking about. I think a big winner from this is Tyrese Maxey. As far as, hey, you've seen me grow. How much of this growth was, boy, you need to do this because we need you to play at a high enough level. Here's the opportunity. Mm-hmm. He took advantage of it. So now, can he take what he's done very well and scale that down in a natural way? And like, I think the beauty of it is we've seen him play next to James Harden. So this is not like a completely new experience. So it's not like, sure, the ball is going to be out of Tyrese Maxey's hand. And we get to get Tyrese Maxey off ball. We get to potentially use Tyrese Maxey to fly him off pin down, staggers, flares, get him off movement, let him kind of take what he's built on ball. But okay, I can just move around. I can get downhill. I can kind of change speeds. I can be the movement hub for our team. And You get inverted pick and roll with LeBron James and Tyrese Maxey. And that's the one where I'm like, hey, how much potential is going to be there for those two to kind of play together? We know LeBron has always enjoyed, hey, give me a guard. Let's get a screen. Do you want to switch this? Do you want to show and recover? Maxey can pop. Maxey can slip. Maxey can close out, make a three. That's going to be fun. You can invert it. LeBron can screen for Maxey. Same difference. Do you want to switch? Now we get LeBron on the short roll. That can be fun for the Sixers. So that combination is going to be very good. Back to the tempo point you made. Okay, what does this open up for movement for Jaylen Brown? How do you involve him? Where's his cutting? Like, I think the cutting between Brown and James is going to be interesting. How do they get there? When do they get there? I think that his ability, Jaylen Brown, to self-create, but also he's not used to being in a place that's asked him to move the ball or move his body. So what does that look like, and how many different combinations can they get? How much do they want to go side to side? Like, Joel Embiid, the roles aren't necessarily the same. I won't sell you on that. I'm not going to use the words lob threat. He has a pressure point as far as, if you're one of these players in the starting lineup, all you have to do is engage the big, right? Mm-hmm. And whether he pops or short rolls, you get two on the ball, you get it back to him, he can flow into the next one. And so he's had that chemistry with Maxey. We've seen multiple possessions where, okay, two on the ball, back to Embiid. And he's like, actually, wherever you're at, come right back. I got a handoff for you. And so we can get that. Look at the players you can do that with now. And so I think that's where, if you're the Sixers, building that out is going to be really fun to see how they kind of piece that together.
No, I love that. I think two things I wanted to bounce off of there, because you mentioned the screening portion with Tyrese Maxey as part of the overall off-ball package for him. And he was, including the playoffs, he was just outside the top 10 in off-ball screens received last year. And that was a big part of his boom last year. It wasn't just he did run more pick and roll because he had to, but the Sixers were pretty intentional about, let's use you as a screener for Joel Embiid to set up a post touch. Let's use you as a screener for Joel Embiid before you fly off your own screen and then set up some of your touches that way. So like that stuff's already baked into the offense. And now if you are doing that with now LeBron James on the weak side or Jaylen Brown on the weak side, any kind of tilting, any kind of rotating, those guys get to attack a defense that's already bent, that's going to be a lot tougher to deal with. So I'm fascinated to see what that portion looks like. Jaylen Brown was also in the top 20 in off-ball screens received last year in Boston, different offenses. But to your point, there is an element of, we get, if LeBron is initiating or if it's just Joel Embiid at the elbow, you could get Jaylen Brown and Tyrese Maxey. Like we saw in Boston all the time. If it was Marcus Smart initiating or Derek White initiating, Jaylen Brown's coming off a pin down on one side, Jason Tatum's coming off a pin down on the other side. Philly can replicate that and have Jaylen Brown and Tyrese Maxey flying off stuff at the same time. And as a defense, you have to choose what you want to do on that front. And then I want to circle back to a transition point that you made a little bit earlier. LeBron James is absolutely going to juice that. One of the things I was looking at as I was prepping for this one was just how much LeBron James impacts transition frequency for his teams. Because naturally, he has been one of the best transition scorers in league history. And so actually seeing numbers on it, and Steve, literally every season of his career, he has juiced the transition frequency for his team, both overall and I think in terms of like pushing off of misses is all but 2 years of his career. The Sixers were 13th, just outside the top 10 in transition frequency in both areas last year. Yeah, it might get kind of funny dealing with the Sixers in transition this year when you have that kind of outlet passing from LeBron if he grabs the board or if someone else gets it, as you mentioned, he could just dart down the middle of the floor. And you got to deal with that freight train still. Like, that was one of the more underrated pieces of the Lakers' transition attack last year, where there was some of the questioning of, okay, who's going to handle it between LeBron and Luka? It's like, oh, well, if Luka's got it, he's tossed a 70-yard darts to LeBron, and vice versa. LeBron can toss those ahead to Luka as well. So that part is going to be a lot of fun. Was there something else that you wanted to hit on with the offense? Because I had a defense question for you.
No, we'll get to the defense. I want to stick around. I want to stay here. I like where we're at. Okay. I think we're having fun. To the offense portion, one of the first things I thought of 2 days in is, you know, we have death, we have taxes, we have Nick Nurse running weave action. So the first time that we have the dribble handoff sequence between LeBron James, Jaylen Brown, and Tyrese Maxey with Joel Embiid screening and rolling, going to be something. Mm-hmm. I guess one of my final, well, it's not my final, but I guess a question I'd lob to you is, what is your concern with this team offensively? Because we've seen a lot of people say, hey, they don't have shooting. Hey, there's only one basketball. Is there a concern that you have with this starting five?
I think I do have like a baseline question of what the shooting level is ultimately going to get at, because we have seen in different years LeBron have really good catch and shoot seasons. We've seen what Tyrese Maxey can do off the catch. Jaylen Brown, like if you just look at his catch and shoot numbers, 1 year, holy crap, Jaylen Brown's knocking down shots. The next year, holy crap, Jaylen Brown's like 33% on catch and shoots. Next year, holy crap, he's up to 38%. Next year, down to 34%. So like, I think it's fair to wonder, like with LeBron and Jaylen Brown in particular, like what level they're going to get at. And I think more importantly, especially if we're talking playoff stuff for the Sixers, what level of closeouts are they going to get when they are spaced? Because I think if teams are afraid of them as catch and shoot threats, that opens up more of the catch and drives, which I think they're going to be at their best. If teams are like, actually, if that's Jaylen Brown at the left wing, if he makes it cool, if not, then even cooler, then that could still some of the potential of this group. So like, I would keep an eye on that portion. There's obviously like the health part of this. Like LeBron is going to be 42 this year and Joel Embiid has not been healthy. So like, didn't want to spend time on there because that is just very low hanging fruit to grab. Like obviously this team does not reach its potential if those two in particular are not fully healthy. But yeah, I would say shooting, keeping an eye on the tempo overall. And I guess the last thing that I would toss your way would be like how often the Jaylen Brown actions are switched and what that does for their overall flow. So I think he's talented enough to score against switches, as we've seen. But if we're just talking about building the boat of we are an ever-present threat, you are always in rotation, et cetera, I do wonder if we see more switching with him involved in particular than people are anticipating, what that means.
Okay, so here's the thing. I'll table the switching point for a second. Let's get back to the shooting portion of the program. I think it's easy to point to that as a concern. I think spacing is key. My counter is the ability to make shots versus the ability to generate quality shots. And I think it ties into your point about the switching. I don't imagine the Sixers are not going to be able to generate quality looks. Like, obviously, the starting five is starting five. They're going to hit pressure points. They're going to make defense to make decisions. Also, throughout the lineups, when you sub people out, you are going to have pressure points. The four of these people, Maxey, LeBron, Jaylen Brown, Joel Embiid, they've been game planned for. And so I'm going to touch on that in a second because I think that's a really important factor. But they're going to be able to make defenses think about what they're doing. So, yes, I do agree. If defenses are able to settle in and say, actually, go ahead and let that fly because we are picking to protect the paint or we are taking this out of person X's hands, that could potentially be an issue. But I don't doubt that they're going to be able to generate quality shots. I think that's like an important thing to hit on. And like to the switching point, right? I think when you have a lot of high usage players who score the basketball well, it's easy to kind of figure out and like, hey, can they scale down? I don't think it's always copy and paste that they have to do that all the time to be successful, especially in this context. I think all these guys are kind of on the same page. It's probably the perfect time for them to come play together. What about a world where these guys make each other's lives easier? How much value is that? And part of the Sixers program is how do you want to guard these guys? You mentioned switching against Jaylen Brown. That's fine. Ball moves. Two other people are involved in action. Do you want to switch that one as well? And so I think that's where it's going to get interesting for Philadelphia. What kind of shots do you want to give these players? When you want to play drop? Okay, Tyrese, Jaylen Brown, make pull-ups. What happens when they make them? Okay, you want to switch? Well, Joel Embiid comes to the screen. You want to switch with Joel Embiid? You want to switch to Tyrese Maxey? Like, they can kind of like put pressure on teams because who's going to guard who? It's a tough five to deal with, especially in a playoff context. Like, think about what we saw in the playoffs, right? We saw Boston sell out to try and take away Tyrese Maxey in pick and roll. Big dropped all the way back. Early help is in. Fantastic. Well, imagine the kick being to Jaylen Brown if you're showing that early help, or LeBron's able to cut. That's a little bit different. We saw in Los Angeles where Luka was operating in pick and roll and it's two on the ball and it's kicked to LeBron and what that looked like. We've seen the Sixers be really intentional with their spacing around Joel Embiid in the post, right? Do you want to double? How much help do you want to show? Hey, here's Jaylen Brown one pass away, LeBron two passes away on the opposite wing, Tyrese Maxey in the opposite corner. How much fun would they have against the tilted defense? And if you stay at home, how much space does Joel Embiid have to operate with? And that's where I get intrigued with this team because I think they can hit a lot of different pressure points. I think in my mind, they are likely a team that is built for the playoffs more than the regular season, but they are going to need the regular season to become as sharp as possible for the playoffs. And that is going to be the fun balance to see how do they develop, what are the attempts going to be? Because in theory, hey, if you're managing Joel Embiid, if you're managing if you're managing LeBron James, you have Maxey, Brown, Edgecombe, you have enough talent off the bench with Simons and Dean Wade, you can figure things out. You did it last year, you can do it this year. But you are going to need to figure out what's the best for these five, what players play well together when we go to the bench. Like, there's things that are going to have to get done. Can they do enough of that and win enough games to raise the playoff ceiling? Because that's not a fun five to deal with.
Yeah.
Or are they gonna have to figure some things out? Like, that's where the fun becomes really fun for me offensively.
No, I'm right there with you. You sparked multiple thoughts on that end, so I promise we're gonna get to the defense. So I think one, I 100% agree with you. There is the high point, there's the ceiling here where you just do not get to rest against Philly at all with the way that they, not only just the talent, but the way they space around the talent, the way they move those guys around. As you mentioned, if pull-ups are flowing for the Sixers this year, what do you do? Do you have to be more aggressive by default? Does that open up more short roll opportunities? Does that help Philly get to the rim? They were sixth in rim rate last year, and this is not with this version of the team. Obviously, adding Jaylen Brown, adding LeBron James, avenues to where that gets even better. The other end is tied to the switching portion, and I guess it's kind of like a broader shot profile bit, as Philly was bottom 10 in three-point rate, around middle of the pack and mid-range rate. we're now adding Jaylen Brown to the mix. We know he wants to get those shots up as well, in addition to the drives. And so if this does become a situation where teams are like, we're not giving hard closeouts to some of these guys, we're willing to switch a little bit more than you anticipate, do we see, like, do they lean into more of the threes? What does that do for their overall shot diet? What does that do for their overall offensive efficiency? Could that be a situation where the pull-ups aren't a bonus? We need the pull-ups to open up everything else. Like, I think that could be a subtle shift that makes life a little more difficult than people might anticipate with Philly's offense, at least early on. So, like, that is a question that I'll at least hold in the back of my head until we get an actual sample with those two. But that piece is going to be fascinating. And then question that I had for you, Steve, because you've hit on this twice now, and I agree that you have this quartet of star talent. You can mix and match. What do you think the stagger pairings are going to be? Like, which two would you keep together? Or which pairs would you keep together?
That's a hard question to answer in July, just because what two would you not want to do? I mean, I think we've seen Maxie and BJ play well together. I think LeBron and Embiid would play well together. If it's BJ and Jaylen Brown, or Maxie and Jaylen Brown, or Maxie and LeBron, like, I'd feel like it's one of those things I'd have to see. And especially because who are they playing with, right? And so who enhances Anthony Simons? Who enhances their bigs who can roll, as far as Bona and Huck Porty? Like, what? Who do you want to play with those guys? What are you building out for them to a degree? So what's the package look like with those people? Is it more movement and flow? Okay, maybe I see more three-guard lineups. Is it more, hey, we want to space the floor? Maybe I see Embiid plus insert player here. What are they, like, that's what they're going to have to figure out, is how do you kind of balance this throughout the game, and what do these lineups kind of run together? Because I think you'll have a different fit when you have Embiid off the court and you have those two bigs who can screen, roll, and will defend hard. Okay, well, this might open up a little bit more of the flow in Tyrese Maxey on ball, BJ Eshkum on ball, Jaylen Brown on ball. How much do we need LeBron with that lineup? Maybe we don't. Maybe we save LeBron and maybe he plays with Anthony Simons. They go in better pick and roll and put pressure on you that way with Dean Wade. Like, the combinations are intriguing. So it's like, in my brain, I'm like, I think this is the problem with summer, right?
You can ask got a lot of time to think.
Well, no, everything feels great. Optionality is endless. We can do everything in July and August. And then it's like, okay, this doesn't work. This doesn't work. This doesn't work. This works. So I want to see what they try, but I think it's going to depend on who's out there together and what players earn the minutes to kind of just be strong second unit people.
Oh, I like it. I think, like, as you mentioned, it is July right now, so plenty of time, but we'll actually get some answers once we get into preseason or regular season play. The first thought that I had when I was thinking about this yesterday and some more this morning was, like, I wonder if it's going to be Tyrese and Jaylen, and if it's going to be LeBron and Embiid. And I was thinking more to the latter portion, like, one, if you want to just get into, like, the elbow stuff and the post-up packages between those two, let's slow it down while the young guys rest. It makes sense to do that. You get the entry passing for LeBron, for Joel Embiid. And then defensively, hopefully a more consistently engaged LeBron defensively, since he's not going to have the same offensive workload. The backline stuff with LeBron, I think, could maybe unlock a little bit more scheme versatility with Joel Embiid in those minutes. And, like, part of that is just going to be health dependent. How much do we want to test out Embiid's knee? But if you just zoom out with the Embiid experience overall, we have seen him flow into late switches and hold serve. We have seen him at the level and bother folks. We've certainly seen him in the drop and kind of being the traffic cop and directing traffic and things like that. If you have LeBron, he's locked in as his front court partner. And this is also where I think the addition of Dean Wade is important. You can just have both of those guys at the four alongside Joel Embiid and feel pretty good about it at the high end. That does unlock a level of aggression that Nick Nurse in particular, as we saw during this Toronto era, he doesn't mind wrapping things up and putting two on the ball. And so, like, that's kind of where I went initially. But then it was like, we have seen, obviously, Maxie and Joel Embiid have just played together the longest. Does it make sense to keep those two paired together? You have LeBron with some of the playmaking duties alongside Jaylen Brown, if you stagger it that way. Also, again, taking those playmaking duties away from Jaylen Brown, you can just score. Jaylen Brown obviously has the experience playing with Jason Tatum, who is not LeBron, but similar, like, playmaking forward that can just kind of oscillate on and off the ball if necessary. Does that make more sense as a natural pairing? So, like, those were the two primary ones that I thought about on that front.
Okay. No, I like that. It was a good question, too. Fun conversation. and we can wrap the offense up here to a degree, because I think we've talked a lot about the potential on what the ceiling could be. I will say, I think it's clear there's going to be some non-negotiables to a degree. Like, as much as LeBron should help them with facilitation, because if you go look up the percentage of assists that were Tyrese Maxey plus VJ, it was maybe a lot more than you would want from two players on your team. They are going to have to commit to having enough pace and tempo in the half court. It can't be too slow. It can't be solely relying on the pressure points to open things up. They're going to have a combination of both. I mean, that's going to be really key. So that's important. And so I think if it's too slow, if the shots aren't falling, if you're only relying on, hey, the defense is a little bit scared of us, I don't know if that's going to be the boat that's going to carry you towards the championship you want. Now, the biggest question mark, or one of the biggest question marks, has to be what this Philadelphia 76ers team is going to be defensively. And so I think the positive of adding LeBron James to this team is it should be a scenario to highlight his defensive strengths at this point in his career. Great communication, tremendous weak side help, really good roamer, rotates, kind of sets things in place. He should be able to do that. The question is, what can they build as a team defensively? That's going to be the key. How much help? When are you going to show? How many covers do you want to hit? How much versatility can this team build throughout the season to prepare for the playoffs? Does it make Jaylen Brown have to be more of an active on-ball defender? Does it make VJ Edgecombe have to be more of an active on-ball defender? Do you have scenarios where teams are able to poke at, all right, well, we're going to move LeBron around the board. We're going to put Tyrese Maxey in action. We're going to put Joel Embiid in action. We're going to be able to poke at different things, because as good as the Sixers were, they didn't necessarily have the consistency defensively. They had enough, but it wasn't necessarily their calling card. And I think we saw the interesting part about that Boston series is they showed the formula of what they wanted to do pretty early on, right? We want to be active. We want to be physical. We want to work to deny. We want to rely on effort to make up for issues. I think you can do a lot of that. How many of those notes can you hit consistently within the starting lineup? How many lumps are you willing to take? What are you trying to throw into the mix in the regular season to see what could work in the playoffs? And how much of all of this relies on the version of Joel Embiid that you can get? Because as much as we can point to the Boston series, a lot of people are going to point to the New York series in the games that Embiid played and said, well, he was in a drop, tried to move up, didn't work, nothing worked. So where are you at with this team defensively? And what do you think it can achieve?
Ooh, I am fascinated by what this defensive group can be. And again, the boring cloud over all this is just how healthy will everyone be, because that's going to determine what the ultimate ceiling is. But sans that, it was one of the questions that I wanted to ask you heading into this one, just what the base for this defense was going to be overall. Because as we've seen under Nick Nurse so far in the Sixers' tenure, like, they've been hovering around the top 10 in terms of how often they go to drop coverage and pick and roll. The switch rate has gotten lower every year. And, like, obviously some of that's personnel-based, some of that's injury-based, but they aren't a team that switches a ton. We've seen them be building a pack in terms of putting two on the ball. We've seen them be a top 10 unit, going back to the 24-25 season, putting two on the ball, and then back to the middle of the pack this past year. And they've been pretty consistently in the top 10 in terms of how often they go to zone this year. And so I was just kind of curious, like, what Nick Nurse is going to feel emboldened to try, considering Jaylen Brown and LeBron James are now in tow, because there is like a level of, if not collective size, at the very least collective positional strength that I think would blend nicely into leaning more into the switching. And when you have someone on the back line like LeBron James, as you talked about his communication in particular, this may be a situation where the Sixers, who were 29th in switch rate last year, may feel more comfortable saying, actually, let's just flatten all this stuff out. And because we have LeBron James, we trust that he can just scram Tyrese Maxey out of some of these matchups. And because Tyrese Maxey is as fast as he is, he could just dart to the corner pretty quickly before teams can get there. And if we're in rotation, again, we got LeBron James on the back line, ideally. We have Joel Embiid on the back line, ideally. And maybe that's how we can figure things out. What would worry me about that, however, at least looking at what last year's team was, you mentioned the Philly defense was pretty inconsistent last year. A pretty consistent through line for them last year is that they were a bad defensive rebounding team. As fun as the transition stuff offensively can be, and as boring as this conversation piece may be, they do have to end possessions at a much higher rate than they did last year. And so LeBron should help on that front. But if this is a situation where LeBron is flying around or LeBron is switching, he's now on the perimeter, are they actually able to hit those dots as consistently as you want because you have smaller guys underneath? And again, this wasn't a good rebounding team last year. And I think they were more middle of the pack the year before that as well. So like, I am just kind of fascinated by what they land on base wise, how aggressive do they want to be initially? And depending on what the matchups are, how consistently can they actually end possessions so you can get the fruits of the labor on the other end?
Yeah, they're going to, I mean, like, we can talk about the ceiling they have, but if the defense doesn't hit a certain level, they don't get there, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I think that's fair to say. Like, the East is too strong. The East is too good. So they have the talent. They should have the personnel, but you are going to have to go through the journey of figuring out what works and does not work for this team defensively. Who can guard who? How do you want to handle different matchups? What's the help? What do you do when you double? How much do you want to double? Are you going to put two on the ball? When do you do that? How do you mix coverages? Like, I think there's a lot of things they're going to have to figure out on that end of the floor. And they're going to have to be strong enough and have enough of a base to be able to take some hits. Like, it's just not, I don't think this is going to be a perfect world defense. But you know me, can you get to, we've done our job as a team? Can we take certain things off the table? And now, okay, you think you can attack Tyrese Maxey, actually he's holding up. Now where are you going to go? Because that's where having LeBron and Jaylen Brown helps. Like, how much does having LeBron make Joel Embiid more decisive to a degree? Because we've seen Embiid be able to mix coverages and kind of just be like, you don't actually know what I'm going to do until I get there. You might think it's a drop and I just jump you real quick. You might think I'm going to come up all the way. And that's when he's feeling well. Like, obviously, when the health isn't there, we know it's a deep drop. He's going to have to figure it out. He's going to try his best to kind of try and navigate it. Doesn't always go well when he's not healthy. If he's healthy, that may change a lot of the conversation. Because if he's back to, boy, I feel good defensively, I'm just going to throw curveballs at you, especially because I know I have people behind me that are going to help, I think that changes the map a little bit. And so I'm intrigued to see, like, I don't want to put all the pressure in the world on Joel Embiid, but how much does this benefit him overall is probably the question I would ask. Like, I know we're sticking with the defense, I'll tuck it, but like,
yeah.
If Big Fella's healthy and he's back to doing what he did defensively, it gets interesting.
Oh, no. The ceiling absolutely gets higher because of what you mentioned, his ability to kind of mix coverages. And I think if you can throw those kind of looks at offenses, that once again, you're forcing misses, you're ideally forcing turnovers, which is a quieter thing that I'm going to be monitoring. We talked about this a little bit during the episode where we talked about the Paul George, Jaylen Brown trade. PG, with what he did off the ball, he's generating steals. Jaylen Brown has never been a guy that did that at a high level. And so that's also, I think, factored into your earlier question of like, who's guarding who, type of matchups being taken on. We saw in Boston last year, matter of fact, the opening game against Philly, it is Jaylen Brown defending Joel Embiid. So they can get into like Nemeas Kadar as a roamer and things like that. So I do wonder how often Nick Nurse is going to be willing to tap those kind of cross-matching buttons, what that part's going to look like. Beyond that, though, I'd imagine VJ Edgecombe, you were defending perimeter score number one. Jaylen Brown, you were defending perimeter score number two, unless it's a marquee, in which case Jaylen Brown will take seniority. He would just want to take those on, like we saw the Kawhi game against the Clippers in particular last year. and then we just kind of flow and play from there. So I think that part is going to be fun. We got to jump in?
Well, no, I was going to ask a reckless question. So if you want to finish your point, that's fine.
Oh, no, give me the reckless question.
What if this is actually the year Jaylen Brown becomes the best two-way player in the NBA?
I tell you what. The Sixers would certainly take that. And I think based on the talent around him, this is a year in which he can scale down enough offensively that he has more juice to give more consistent punch defensively. Like for me, like best two-way player is always tough because you're talking about Giannis, Shea, depending on how you feel about the defense. Like it's tough to get to that level, particularly offensively with some of the limitations. But this is absolutely a season where Jaylen Brown, like, what a Jaylen Brown all defense like campaign, won't say firmly top 10, but like him being in the conversation, would that surprise me? Not a ton, considering what's around him and the on-ball chops that he has displayed sometimes. Like this is a context in which he could tap into that. Now, we're going to see, because it's easy, as you mentioned, it's July right now. if we get to the regular season and Tyrese Maxey has a cold start, or LeBron suffers an injury, or Joel Embiid's out, and now Jaylen Brown is soaking up usage similar to last year's Boston team, then that's probably going to be off the table completely because he just has to do more offensively. So obviously things can change, but this is a context that he could have one of, if not the best defensive season of his career. And I think, again, from the event creation standpoint, they're going to need that type of aggression, not just on the ball, but him being more locked in off the ball to help them maintain. Yeah, they were, I think, eighth in opponent turnover rate last year, the Sixers were. That's going to be different with these guys in tow. Like, can they force that? And that goes back to my baseline question of how aggressive does Nick Nurse want to be with this group? Because if Joel Embiid's feeling good and you feel like this could be more of an at the level or just flat out hedging gear for him, LeBron can still fly around on the back end. Jaylen Brown can make plays off the ball. It's more so like when he relaxes his shoulders that he gets in trouble. This could be a year where the Sixers are still forcing turnovers. And again, you get to all the fun stuff on the other end of the floor. So I am fascinated to see what this part's going to look like.
No, I like that. Tremendous answer. I have a Joel Embiid question. I was just thinking in the back of my head. We talk about his health. Obviously, it's important. When it comes to Joel Embiid's health, are you looking for availability or mobility?
I think literally any other year it's going to be mobility. But I think because you're adding such massive talents into the room, I think the chemistry building is going to be so important for this group. Just factoring in, like, defensively, what coverages do we want to execute and win? What cross matches do we want to tap into and win? Offensively, what are we running? How fast are we running it? What are our spacing principles, et cetera? I think this year the availability is probably a little bit more important than the mobility. Because I think if the mobility is compromised, in theory, you have the talent to offset that, particularly offensively. We saw last year when he wasn't 100%, there's still just a level of pressure that he generates because you can't just station him 12 feet from the basket and teams have to make a decision. Or you can just space up and just sprinkling those mid-range jumpers either way. Defensively, if you have more size, you have more defensive talent around him, and then at any given time, you can still be in Dean Wade and get more size beside him as well. Like, you want the mobility? The answer is yes. I think the availability is a little bit more important this year so they can actually chemistry build. Where would you land on that?
I think mobility. Okay. I think if you can manage Embiid, but when he's out there, he's more mobile. We're able to do different things. It can tap into driving a little bit more. I think that gets you closer to where you want to go. You know, I think it's obviously you would want him to play. Like, we're always rooting for health here at the Thunder spot. But I think if he's able to be closer to himself, like, I think when you look at how often he's come back, he's been like through hell in a cell every time that he's returned. At some point, it's like, hey, this guy, how's he doing this? Like, I noticed, I was like, he's falling, so he doesn't land on his legs. Like, can he just exist? Like, that's all I want. Like, can he just exist as a person who can play basketball? That's my biggest thing. Did you have any final Sixers thoughts or anything else you want to throw in?
I think we've hit the LeBron portion pretty in depth. Like, there are some super granular things we could tap into, but I think we've nailed all the big picture things. I want to ask you very quickly, as again, I think Kentavious Caldwell-Pope is slated to clear waivers later today. That is another depth piece for the Sixers that should tap into the line of versatility. In theory, gives you another two-way piece to factor in. Just how do you see him impacting this group overall?
Defending players and making threes.
That is pretty straightforward. That's pretty streamlined. There you go. Like, I think for me with KCP, like, one, yes, broad strokes, that's what he's going to be asked to do. And I think if he nails those notes, he's going to help the Sixers. The three-point shooting has been kind of weird for him the last few seasons, so I am curious to see, like, where he lands on that front. He certainly isn't in, like, peak fringe all defense levels defensively. The Memphis year was an odd one for him. And I say odd because like, one, the three-point shooting wasn't where we were accustomed to with KCP. He did, I think, have a career high in assists. And, like, he showcased a little bit more off-the-dribble juice than I anticipated. And I'm curious, like, how much of that was system slash maybe lower expectations versus maybe he just processed the floor as a driver a little better than people anticipate. And if that part carries over, that does give Philly not just another, like, 3-and-D guy, but another guy that can kind of keep the chains moving for them. And like, depending on what that looks like, I'm curious how that impacts what type of lineups Nick Nurse wants to get into once he does go into the staggering piece. Like, is he more able to play alongside, like, if it's Jaylen Brown and Joel Embiid in particular? Does he make more sense in those staggering lineups now because he has a little bit more off the dribble juice? If double teams come for Embiid, if Jaylen Brown's seeing help on those drives, is he able to drive those closeouts and create shots for those stars again because he's more comfortable or just kind of bouncing off of the experience that he had at Memphis last year? Like, that's a baseline question that I have on that front. But, like, getting him for the minimum, things a good bit, because if he doesn't hit the notes, you don't have to play him. Like, that could just flow right into more. Anthony Simons is generally in the guard room. You could ramp up the minutes again for Maxi Edgecombe. So, like, I like the signing for Philly, assuming that, again, he clears waivers and it ultimately happens, because that seems to be where it's trending at the very least.
Yeah, if it happens, I mean, it's low risk, high reward. I mean, if he plays well, it's going to open up versatility for you lineup-wise, as all the things you stated. I won't restate them. I have done the Kentavious Caldwell-Pope thing long enough to know. Whenever you in the world thinks he can't shoot, he makes shots. And whenever you in the world believes, hey, we got him to make shots, he doesn't make as many as you expected. That's been the Kentavious Caldwell-Pope journey almost the entire time. And you can go look up the statistics. I'm not telling lies. Go ask a Pistons fan if KCB could shoot, and then he started to make shots. And guess what? He wasn't there anymore. And he did it in L.A. And he did it in Washington. And he did it in Denver. And Orlando was like, cool, make shots. And the Memphis was like, cool, make shots. I'm just telling you, I don't know how it works, but it's kind of what it is.
I tell you what, he better make shots this year. Okay, final big picture question that I have for you, Steve. Is Philly your Eastern Conference favorite right now? No. Are they the best team in the East? Okay.
No. You know me. You know me. You know me, big dog. I respect champions. It's still the Knicks at the top for me until proven otherwise. I do think the Eastern Conference is incredibly dynamic and it's wide open. And you're going to have to get off to a good start. Because if you look at the type of teams and the type of moves that have been made, one of the quote-unquote good teams will not be in the playoffs. Between the Knicks, Detroit, Boston, Cleveland, Toronto, Philly, Atlanta, I just named seven teams off the top of my head. One of them will not be in the top six. So one of a team that has made a move is going to be in the play-in potential. So I don't have the Sixers necessarily as the top in the East. I think they have a high ceiling because of the playoff ability to scale up in that context. I am curious to see how many games they are able to win in the regular season and what position they put themselves in. If it's a top three team with what they have roster-wise and everyone's healthy in the playoffs, look out. Going to be a problem. If they're having to figure things out, they're having to deal with, you know, the type of season they had last year and they have to fight upwards, I think it's interesting. But I think with what they've put together, they're absolutely one of the top teams in the East. I just don't have them at the top.
No, I think that is perfectly fair. I think, as you mentioned, there is a world in which they are relatively healthy, they gel, and they are like the first or the second seed in the East. There's also a world that they try to figure things out, they deal with some injury stuff, and it is the Sixers win 44-45 games. They have like a top 10 net rating. They're seventh or eighth because of the strength of the conference. And now it's winning an extra game or potentially two to then get into the playoffs without home court against a really good Eastern Conference team. And it's like, darn, this is just kind of a draw. There are going to be jokes because that's just how the discourse works. But it's like, well, this is pretty darn tough to deal with. Like, we saw similar things in the Western Conference. Like, you can be really good and still not be good enough. And so I am fascinated. I would probably say they are, probably say like tier 1.5, tier 2, just off the top of my head. And then I'll see how things gel, how healthy they are. But like, That's a lot of talent. And as we talked about on Friday and earlier in the offseason, I was already pretty in on what the Sixers offseason was. And now you trade for Jaylen Brown and you also sign LeBron James and add KCP on top of that. Like, they have really done a good job of rounding out this roster. So,
yeah, LeBron is a Sixer. His favorite was Michael Jordan. His second favorite was Allen Iverson. He could do the impossible. Sixers fans, stand up. Go get a cheesesteak. You ready to eat it up? Eat it up.
I knew that you were going to try to slip that in, and I'm so mad that I now have to go to break with that being the last thing said in this segment. So we're going to take a break from here. And when we return, one, I will be in a better mental place. Two, we shift to the W side as we react to All-Star and we get into some of the most interesting storylines heading into the second phase of the W season. Please stick with us. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot as we shift to the WNBA side. Steve, we are fresh off of All-Star weekend and plenty of All-Star festivities, and we are naturally leading into the second half or phase two of the WNBA season. Wanted the table set a little bit with All-Star weekend. Back from Chicago, a lot of fun. The All-Star game itself, Steve, was a pretty fun one for me, at the very least. A 129-122 victory for Team Spoon, got the win over Team Coop, which is funny for me considering what their interactions were this entire weekend. Well, you go back to the actual roster draft, there was like, obviously joking around, but a healthy level of competitiveness there. You have the skills competition, the Shooting Stars competition, which we'll get to in a little bit. And they're trading barbs there. And then pregame of the All-Star game, they are cracking jokes about each other, about that contest and how that went. And so Team Spoon getting the last laugh with a 129-122 victory. Jonquel Jones, a near triple-double, being named the All-Star game MVP with 22-13-8 off the bench in that game. And so just broadly speaking, Steve, what were some of your favorite moments from the All-Star game? What were some of your favorite moments from, yeah, we'll stick there.
Well, we really have a tip of the cap to Nekias Duncan for being live and in the building, and we'll get to some of your thoughts from the overall All-Star weekend experience. I want to give a salute to you for once again covering the All-Star game. Big time, big effort, big work. I think for me, the game was fun. Great vibes. Again, just a tremendous celebration of women's basketball, of women's sports, and it's always fun to kind of enjoy that. I thought it was interesting pure game-wise. It looked like Caitlin Clark was going for the MVP right from the jump, launching logo threes. Let's get them up. I'm letting it fly. And I think the funniest part was the defense. Like, yeah, I'm going to deny passing lanes. I'm going to show weak side help. I'm full court pressuring. I was very intrigued by that portion. I was like, okay, I see what's going on. And then after Caitlin Clark did all that, as the subs went on, Marina Mabry checked in. And it was very clear Marina Mabry also wanted the MVP. Because good God, the shots she made in that first quarter, that first half, was tremendous. Mm-hmm. I thought it was funny to kind of watch like Jessica Shepherd just default into dribble handoff mode. That was interesting to me. But that was fun. But like Marina came in and said, I'm letting it fly and I'm not going to stop letting it fly. We had... And I was convinced that she was going to get the MVP after the initial onslaught. I was like, nope, this is happening. But obviously, you know, they didn't win and weren't close enough. I don't think she made a three in the second half, but salute to Marina. The Dominique Malanga attempts to get a dunk was also very fun to start that second quarter.
Yes, it was.
It was like, yeah, let's drop a lob play. Okay, that didn't work. Fast break, Gabby Williams. Oh, that's Dom behind me. Let me throw it up. No, nope, didn't work. And then Dom got the dunk to see. So I enjoyed that. Jonquel just taking the MVP was great, but like I love Dom's like we're just gonna throw it up there. She up there somewhere. That was
she up there somewhere.
beginning was fun. I just thought it was a great vibe. I thought it was interesting, kind of like I think it was like near halftime. They went to Kelsey Plum on the sideline. KP was like, if we gotta put someone on the line, we gotta compete. And Caleb was like, we gotta put on a show, but we gotta compete. And I was like, I hear it, but I'm having fun. Don't know what I'm doing, but I'm having fun. So I had a good time. What was the experience like for you in arena, in the building? What were your takeaways?
Oh, man. Okay, so I think first and foremost, what great atmosphere in the arena. And you could feel that even before intro started, but especially when intro started. Everyone kind of got a crowd pop in this game. Like there were three in particular that got the loudest. The people were hyped for Asia. The people were hyped for Paige. The people were super hyped for Angel Reese. But everyone got a pop. And like normally when you have these all-star events, naturally like the superstars are more well-known than the first timers. So like when they got to announcing like Jessica Shepherd, I was like, okay, I don't know how this is going to go. Is it going to be like a volume drop off? Because outside of Dallas, how many people know? But no, it was just like a pretty healthy, yeah, shout out Jessica Shepherd. I was like, you know what? This is the kind of crowd we can rock with. And as for the people on YouTube can see, It was also just an all-time WNBA All-Star Game attendance record. Nearly 20,000 people in the building at United Center. So that obviously aids the overall vibe of the arena when you have that many people in there. So, like, it was just cool to feel the celebratory vibe in the arena, in addition to, like, the event being stationed for that. So that part was cool. And then we get to the game itself. Like, I'm glad you started with the Caitlin defense, because that was incredible. She literally started the game. The first basket of the All-Star game was Caitlin Clark pick six. And I was like, wait. I'm thinking this is about to be, you know, it's an All-Star game. We're going to get a pick and roll. There's going to be no low man help. Someone's just going to waltz in. That shot's good. Like, Caitlin, like, nah. I see you, team. I see you, Team Coop. Which I will give a quick salute to the Team Coop clipboard. Like, you alluded to the back screen play for Dom to start the second quarter. They were actually running some offense in this game, which I was intrigued by. Like, it was a whole lot of let's go double drag into a stagger for Kelsey Mitchell and others. I'm just like, oh, you've been watching games. This is like some actual install. That's very funny. Now, of course, because it's an All-Star game, this is all being ran at like 30% speed. But it's like cool to see the concepts at the very least. But no, Caitlin came in with the defense and then also not just three-point shooting. She came in with logo shots. I was like, oh, this is going to be one of those. And as you mentioned, Marina Mabry lets it fly. Aside from the Dominique Malanga dunk, because I think quietly you can also put her in the I want All-Star Game MVP camp, she was driving the basketball a lot in that second quarter. Like, she very much get a catch at the elbow, get a catch at three-point line. Oh, I don't care about you, Jonquel Jones. I'm getting here. Now, it did get kind of funny because we had the mix of, like, the failed lob attempts. And then she missed like three or four layups in a row. And like with every miss, she got more and more demonstrative with her laughing at herself as those rolled off. And I was like, oh, Dom really wants this. This is so adorable. This is very funny. But I'm glad she was able to get the dunk. Dunked it clean too. Not that it's a surprise because we've seen it in Unrivaled and seen it in other contexts, but it did not look like it took much effort for her to get that done. So that part was fun for me. And I think just the overall gamesmanship, like Gabby Williams very early on, like let me take this one-legged three real quick, just cash that as a quick nod. That was cool. Ryan Howard checks in and there's a transition opportunity about to happen. She just fouls whoever it was to stop the fast break so they can set up on defense. So it's like, you know what? That's what competition is supposed to look like. Early third quarter, we get a coach's challenge. As Asia Wilson knocked the ball out of bounds and pretty clearly knocked the ball out of bounds, but twirls the finger anyway, we get a review. Post game, she's asked about it. She's like, yeah, I just wanted a break. And I'm just like, okay. So that was a good bit. Also, no legs leave for Asia, which set the internet ablaze. It was like, wait, what is this? Which also drew some questioning on that front. So like that part was fun, but I think the vibes themselves were just pretty high in this basketball game. Oh, go ahead.
Very true. No. I was just going to ask because you had the ability from undisclosed location and undisclosed location to ask about the leg sleeve. What was the response from Asia Wilson?
She said she just did not feel like cutting up one of the sleeves. just didn't feel. She was just like, I didn't think this was going to be as big as it became. But it was literally just, I would imagine she just has like, the leg sleeve, she cuts one off and puts it on, and that's just how that works. And she's like, I just didn't feel like doing all the cutting, so I just did that. But yeah, you roam Twitter or you roam Threads, and there's a whole lot of screenshots of Asia taking shots. Like, who is this? It also didn't help that, like, she starts with the hair down, she clips it up, she does something else, she brings it back down, and this is with no leg sleeves. So everybody's like, wait, who is this big? What is going on here? So I got a subtle laugh out of that one, but heck of a game for Jonquel Jones. Heck of a debut for Olivia Miles as well, who also nearly had a triple-double in this game. 11 points, 12 rebounds, I think 8 assists. Did not miss a shot in this basketball game, which is fascinating to me. And she had her obvious array of like no looks and behind-the-back passes and fun bounce passes. So I wanted to give a quick salute to Olivia Miles as well. I think third rookie in NW All-Star history to record a double-double, joining Kiki Arifin last year and Angel Reese the year before that. So we just have a through line for rookies doing that. So we'll see who keeps the train going next year. But man, last thing I want to say is, I want to just kind of bounce off of your Jonquel Jones point, because like I wasn't anticipating this to be like a Jonquel game based on what the Caitlin and Marina quarters were in particular. And then Olivia Miles filling the stat sheet. And Jonquel just gave you the literal Jonquel blend. Like, I will dive to the basket and get a basket. I'll roll and pick and roll. I'll go pick and pop. I'll get busy off the offensive glass. I'll face up and attack. And it's just, and I'll toss in some dimes on top of that. And it's like, okay. Then you look at the box score. It's like, wait a minute. She has what? Like, she was on triple-double watch at halftime. And as she talked about post-game, hey, coach was drawing up some plays. We can get those last two assists. I could actually get the All-Star game triple-double, follow up with Skylar Diggins lid last year. Ultimately didn't get it done. But she wins MVP, and she is now the only player in W history to win all of the MVPs. Regular season MVP, finals MVP, Commissioner's Cup MVP, and now All-Star game MVP. Just an insane resume. And still one of the more underrated ones in W history, I would say. So I wanted to give a salute to Jonquel Jones as well.
In the conversation of one of them greats. And I think it was funny kind of just experiencing and watching. Oh, Jonquel is just gonna get this, huh? Just like the slow build, the slow climb. Like, it was just like, oh, points there, rebounds there, assists there, team winning. Oh, okay. Oh, more scoring. Oh, more assists, more rebounds. Okay, that's I understand it now. So shout out to Jonquel. I very much enjoyed that. Did you enjoy the Tyler concert?
I personally thought it was fine. Now, in arena, unfortunately, I would just say that the volume was lower than the pregame intros, I think is the way that I would describe it on this here podcast. But I personally thought it was a good performance. I enjoyed it. How did you soak in the Tyler performance? Did you enjoy it?
Two thumbs up. Well done.
Okay.
She indeed did it again. Did you have any other All-Star game thoughts, or did you want to transition to the Friday activities?
I think last thing I would add, and I wish I could have asked about it. I didn't know if the coaches were going to be made available after the game or not. They ultimately were not. But like, we got the opening stint from Aaliyah Boston in that first quarter, and we just did not see her again. NECA start the second half. For Team Spoon, and I was like, wait a minute, what's going on here? And like, Aaliyah was just on the bench, laughing, joking up, cutting up teammates. I didn't think anything was wrong. Fever back in action either tonight or tomorrow. So she's not on the injury report, so I don't think anything's wrong. So I was like, huh, that's an interesting one. And I was wondering why they were starting essentially three bigs in the first half. I was like, okay. I mean, the second half, I was like, all right.
Salute to Aaliyah Boston. Show up, get it done, but also, hey, not feeling great. Nah. Yeah, you know I mean, that's always, we're good. Let's shut it on down. So, you know, these things happen over the course of All-Star games.
There we go. Yeah, I just expect that one from like if NECA had the opening stint late first quarter and then we didn't see her again, it's like, okay, well, she's approaching the most All-Star appearances ever. Like, okay, that makes it. Aaliyah's like super young. Like, I just didn't anticipate that one being a bit. Nothing wrong, but I was just like, okay, that's an interesting one. And then quick salute, Alicia Gray knocking down a bunch of threes. Kelsey Mitchell, 28 points, had the four-quarter surge as Team Coop was trying to make the comeback in the fourth. Okay, to the Friday competition, Steve. The Shooting Stars competition was back, which excites me in particular. I love the competition so much. Love it for NBA All-Star Weekend. I'm so glad that it's here on the W side as well. Team Washington just firmly saying across both rounds, y'all ain't messing with us at all. Elena Deladon, welcome back.
Yeah.
Shakira Austin, let me sprinkle in some buckets. Elena Deladon, welcome back. Also, quick shout out to Holly Rowe. Well, she's like, hey, you look good out there. You want to come back? Elena Deladon gives answer that does not answer that question. Holly Rowe, being Holly Rowe. Respect Holly Rowe. Hey, I didn't hear no. And Elena Deladon says, it wasn't enough. I didn't say no, but I did not say yes. And we transition to the next player to talk to. Oh boy. But Elena Deladon did her thing. Shakira Austin as well. And then Gigi Banks. In a literal sense, I was not familiar with your game. Immediately went to Synergy after the competition ended. It was like, okay, let me see if I can find some clips. Let me see what's going on here. Getting all of, not just the buckets, all of the deep buckets for that matter across both rounds. And just her energy was a lot of fun. You see it during the competition in the post-game presser. Like, she was beaming the entire time and like watching both Elena Deladon and Shakira Austin like actively pour into her during the post-game presser was one of my favorite moments of the entire weekend because she's just soaking all this up. Like, what an experience that has to be for someone that young and that good to be sitting next to literal, you know, all-star level talent in Shakira Austin and a legend in Elena Deladon. And Elena's like, no, like, you have my number. Hit me up if you need literally anything. Very proud of you, et cetera. So I'm just like, that's so cool. And I think beyond the competition itself, like, that's what this is supposed to be for. That's why you have legend, current player, high schooler. Like, we're bridging all these generations together. And so to see the competition was fun, but then to see the pouring into after that, it's like, yeah, this is what this weekend is really supposed to be about.
Nah, that's bridging the gaps was so cool and so fun. So I'm glad you mentioned that. And like, seeing like Rebecca Brunson and Lauren Jackson and EDD back out there. Like, EDD told herself, she said she hadn't shot the ball, but running from spot to spot, I was like, now hold on. Nah. You might, hey, you play some
you
drop.
You cannot trick me.
Hey, I know you got a little bit more to take, EDD. Come on. But I thought that it was just really fun to kind of just watch EDD perform at that high level again, watch Washington take off in that. It's always a fun competition, especially for the team that maybe falls short. Second round got a little more interesting than I thought. But, like, what a blast to see just that combination of the past, the present, the future. And I love that as the W has continued to grow and progress, the legends that kind of laid the foundation throughout the different areas are being recognized. I think that's so important. So salute to that.
Very salute. Can I ask you a quick, respectfully messy free throw?
Sure.
More likely to log another WNBA minute, Elena Delladon or Emma Mieseman?
Oh. I'm going with Emma Mieseman by default because EDD did not say yes. It only tried. So
that's true. I asked that for that initial reaction that you gave. I freaking got him. Now to the 3-point contest. AZ Fudd, hello. Defeats Bridget Carleton in the final round, 31-19. And this is after having 24 in the first round, AZ did, and having to sweat a little bit. And she had more people coming behind her. It's like, hey, this is a good score, but also everybody kind of shooting right now. But she gets to the final round and then just said absolutely not. And I just felt so bad for Bridget Carleton, who lights it up with 29 in the opening round and then watches AZ Fly go for 31 to kick things off. And you have to follow that. And I think Bridget missed, I want to say, two of her first three shots in the opening rack. And I was like, well, darn, that might just be it based on what the AZ score was. But that was tough. But I guess general question for you, Steve, how did you soak in the 3-point contest? Did you have like a prediction heading in, or you were just ready to see what it was going to look like?
I was trying to see what Natisha Hydeman would be able to do in the 3-point contest. So, salute. I thought Marina might pull it off. BC doing what she did in the first round was not surprising. But AZ Fudd locking in that finals and saying, actually, we're going to go ahead and just keep letting it fly and not stop. I think probably my favorite part was the confidence going throughout that final round for AZ Fudd and the turn at the end where it's like, yep, I did that. This is what I do. Like, that's where it's just peak there. So it's hard to deal with, hard to follow if you're BC, who I thought had, like, after that first round, I was like, oh boy, y'all are in danger. BC's here. And it's like, well, that's hard to deal with. Were you surprised by anything?
I think I'm going to answer that. First, I want to say, as you mentioned, the AZ turn, it made me laugh so hard when she did it because, like, she locked in and she drops that score in the final. And then she does the turn. I was like, oh, AZ's here. Immediately breaks character and starts laughing. Just could not at all. just could not at all hold any kind of, like, stink face or anything. I was like, nah, AZ, that ain't you. That's okay. You are a competitor, but you're a competitor with your smile on your face. Like, that just is what it is. As far as surprises go, Bridget getting to 29, I think it's like that. I did think she was going to do pretty well just based on what she is, a really good shooter, and also just based on what her actual shooting form is. I was like, okay, this might be pretty solid with a rack. You know what I mean? So, like, her having a high score didn't surprise me. The literal score kind of did. Janelle Salon ended up having a decent score, but kind of made me sad. And I was like, oh, you know what? The slow load up and how good she is against shot contests, her shooting off of a rack is just like an entirely different context. I was like, ah, this kind of makes sense. I'm glad you hit on the Natisha Hydeman portion, because that reminded me to circle back to the shooting stars. As Courtney Williams did not have her best performance in the Shooting Stars competition, and thus she is actively laughing at herself as she is missing shots in the middle of the competition. Which also reminds me, as I was talking about Safeful Barbs between Cynthia Cooper and Teresa Witherspoon, hey, the spoon passes in that entire competition ended up becoming like, I think that was the first question, shout out the great Megan Hall post event, asking Spoon initially, like, hey, what's going on with those passes? Spoon took accountability and made some jokes at her own expense throughout the entire presser heading into the Sunday All-Star game. So I wanted to salute there. But no, like, AZ's performance was fun. Janelle kind of got me. Marina, I think she needed, I think that's where that first quarter of the All-Star game came from Marina. Because, like, it wasn't the best performance in the three-point contest. I felt like that was, all right, let me lock in. Let me show y'all what I can do. And she bombs away in the first quarter. And then, you know, the rest of the game happens. And I'll talk about it. But either way, very cool Marina weekend overall. Got to talk to Marina a little bit, Steve.
What?
I did. I got to, you know, we've talked about it on the pod in different contexts, like the passing role for her, especially when she gets on the ball. I got to ask her about that. Also got to ask her, another thing that we brought up on this podcast before, when the tempo go to their double drag look and they have that wing slip out, got to ask her about that. What makes it so dangerous? She gave some great insight on that front. So might have some words coming on that soon, might not. But I thought you in particular would get a kick out of that. We got to toss some hoops with Marina Mabry this weekend. I enjoyed it. That has broken Steve's. There it is. Did you have any? Oh, last thing I'd say on 3-point contest. Felt bad for Ryan. Because normally 20 points is enough to advance you. But because of what Bridget Carlton and AZ Fudd did, it's just like, well, darn, thanks for coming. That just kind of stinks. Just objectively a good shooting round for Ryan Howard. It's just, man, speaks to the 3-point shooting talent that we have in the league. Okay, Steve. Well, one, did you have any other general All-Star weekend thoughts that you want to get into before we move?
No, we are recording on a Tuesday morning. We are recording as the second half of the WNBA season is headed for tip-off. So, Nikias, what are some key things that you're looking forward to looking at in this second half of the W season?
Ah, yes. So I think for me, I start at the top of the league. I guess the one seed and now the three seed. We'll go in reverse order. So I start with the Aces defense. Because this time last year, the Aces were still trying to work their way out of the 500 range. And we weren't far away from the Aces suffering the 53-point loss to the Minnesota Lynx. And then they just became the best team in basketball and ultimately win the championship. And so I was kind of looking at where the defense is right now at the All-Star break compared to where it was last year. Now, funny enough, we've added two teams. They were ninth in defensive rating last year and this year heading into the All-Star break. But because we've had this offensive boom, freedom of movement, more free throws, et cetera, et cetera, it was a 102.8 defensive rating at the All-Star break last year. It's a 107.4 this year. So obviously, the defense is just worse than it was last year. And in terms of where they rank, they're at the same area. But half-court defense, slightly worse than where it was last year. Transition defense, which they are the best in terms of points per possession allowed. The Aces have the best transition defense in basketball right now. So that is a positive on their end. Doing a little bit worse on drives compared to last year. Cleaning the defensive glass a little bit better than they were at this time last year. But still around, I think, fifth or sixth in defensive rebound rate. So for me, general storyline for me, as the Aces have talked about their defense all year long, we have had multiple conversations about the Aces defense. I am generally monitoring, is there going to be a switch being flipped in the second half of the year for the Aces? Because if they do, the offense has been on a high level pretty much all year long. That would set them up for, you know, put them in better, in a better context for a potential title defense. And if not, the defense is probably going to be one. So that's probably the top thing that I am monitoring as we enter the second half of the year.
Start the champs. I love doing this podcast with Nikias. He treats the Aces defense like a teenager learning how to drive. And Nikias is just sitting in the passenger seat, holding on to something, trying to give some version of encouragement while being internally stressed out. And he's done this for 5 consecutive years. So I'm not surprised. It's fine. I think the Aces have shown enough of a base. They have to show consistency. If they do, they'll be fine. It's good to go. For me, and I think also for you, it's the team at the top of the list. It's the Minnesota Lynx. Because mm-hmm. before that All-Star break, let me tell you what we saw. We saw Nafisa Collier. And we saw Nafisa Collier in about 24 minutes say, hey, here's a double-double. Don't forget I can give you 20 and 10 real quick. The funniest part about mm-hmm. that was, yeah, you know, Nafisa, Cheryl Reeve tampering expectations. You know, this may not be the fee that you're expecting. There's going to be a little bit of minutes restriction. Let me tell you what Fee said. Nothing about that minutes restriction said anything about not shooting the ball. I'm getting these up in whatever 4-minute stint that I'm going to get. And let me tell you the comfort that she found throughout that game. Ooh, whoo. I can shoot the three. I can get post-ups. You want to, like, the, it's interesting because the space that Fee had to operate with, it was like, oh, that's right. Like, the ball movement, et cetera. Fee gets the ball in paint. Oh, no, no one's around. Hey, would you like to switch? Oh, that's Fee against wing. Oh, no, no one's around. Like, that's, it's going to be interesting. So I think it will take time for Olivia Miles and Fee to develop chemistry. Like, that's, we take two-man game for granted. We take pick and rolls for granted. It takes time for players to understand each other's rhythm and cadence. So keep an eye on that, but don't do the thing where you're like, well, no, don't do that. It's going to take time for them to build that. What I will say is, not going to take any time for Caleb McBride and Nafisa Collier to be on the same page. And let me tell you, the Lynx being able to have Olivia Miles, have ball movement, have a finisher in Nafisa Collier, and they're already good and at the top of the league. Hey.
Yeah.
Hey.
No. It gets spooky, Steve. So 24-10 for Nafisa Collier in her debut in, I think, 22 minutes. She went 1 of 6 in the first quarter. And her last miss, I think, being like a turnaround that she misses, and she yells a word, signifying that she was not pleased with herself after missing said shot. And I think that just kind of clicked something into place for her, where it's like, okay, no, we're not going to continue to do this. I'm on the court, we're going to get buckets. It was like 17 at the half. I was like, well, I think Nafisa Collier is back. It is very funny, like, quickly to your Olivia Miles fee point. I think, to your point, it's going to take some time for them to build, like, their natural chemistry, when to hit Fee in the pocket, et cetera. It felt like a mix of, all right, I'm getting to this early, and if he's like, well, I can take this 3-yard and flow into something else, which can work within the Lynx offense, or it was just Olivia's just getting downhill, and that part was fun. As we started getting into pick, switch, where's Fee, I was like, oh, that's going to be tough, and it hits on your switching point. Like, I don't know what you want to do with that, because you send a double team from anywhere. This is a team that spaces the floor incredibly well. This is a team that shoots the ball incredibly well. This is a team that if you come with help too early, they will cut behind you or screen behind you or both. And if all else fails, like, the ball can just find Olivia Miles again, and she could just beat anybody off the dribble. And that unlocks the chain all over again. And so the one thing that I wanted to hang on here, Steve, and I want to take some self-accountability on this portion, because we have talked about the Minnesota Lynx on this podcast, how great the offense has been, how great the defense has been. They've been the best team in the league, best net rating, best record, all the stuff. One thing that I haven't really said is, like, they should just be the title favorites. It has largely been, man, they're this good and they're going to add Fee. We better look out. They have been so much better than everyone this year. Like, they're the only team in the league with, like, a plus 10 net rating right now. They're now adding Fee into the mix. Should we just say they are the title favorites right now? Not that it's impossible for anyone else to win it. I just started this with the Aces, of course. But, like, I just don't think in a literal sense, I have said the Lynx should be the title favorites. I think they have earned the right to be called the title favorites at the very least.
I think it's fair. I think it's understandable to say that. I mean, they've separated themselves at the top of the pack, and they can only get better, I think, is the scary part. The defense can only get better, especially as Fee gets more comfortable. Olivia Miles has had a counter, an answer for every coverage you want to throw, and now you add Fee to that. Like, I think there's a lot of things they can get better at. And, like, Cheryl Reeve has very quickly said, hey, we need our defense to be better. Like, if you listen to the Lynx broadcast in that last game, hey, the defense is not great. We need to be better. So, like, there's more they can do, and they've played very well so far. What else are you looking forward to in the second half of the season, guys?
Steve, which is very funny for the long-term Dunkers, but we have to talk about the Washington Mystics. And I want to talk more about the Washington Mystics this week if we can. So we're going to see. But for right now, the Washington Mystics are towards the top of my list in intrigue. For a team this young to defend at this high of a level, like, you just generally do not see that. Young players just need time to learn the intricacies of defense. And because of the collective size, the collective activity, the collective aggression of this group and the versatility of their bigs, the Mystics just put you in a headlock. And they have been putting teams in a headlock pretty much all year long. Like, they can tap into the full court pressure package if necessary. But more than anything, it's very similar to the Golden State Valkyries, where if you dribble the ball inside the arc, there are going to be multiple bodies that you got to contend with. You're going to have someone on your hip. There's going to be someone at the nail, and then you got to deal with more size and length at the rim. And it's just generally in this not an enjoyable experience for opposing offenses. I mean, yeah, for opposing offenses. The one thing that's kind of had me in a headlock with the Mystics is like, I love watching them on defense. I enjoy their spacing principles on offense, but I don't know how consistently they can generate good looks offense. And that was the only thing that's kind of holding me back on like what their ultimate ceiling is. Heading into the All-Star break, Steve, their two best regulations, two of their three best regulation scoring games against the Golden State Valkyries and then again against the Las Vegas Aces heading into the break. And I'm just like, well, hey, those are two games, so we will see how the offense looks in the second half. That's kind of where I want to start. But this defense has been so good all year long. There's now a gap between them and like ninth seed. They have some room to move up to seven or maybe even six. I am just keeping an eye on the Mystics and where they ultimately land in the standings, because this is just firmly a quality group, headlined by an elite defense already.
But the pump fake is real, and this is where we go back and forth a little bit. I think for you, the offense is going to just have you just holding back. You're not going to send that text. You're not going to pick up the phone and make that call. Doesn't matter sometimes. A defense-first team that knows who they are, what they can do, what they can't do, there's nothing you can tell me about the Washington Mystics that tells me they don't know exactly who they are. They don't know exactly what makes them good. Does it work out every night? Maybe not. But you have to deal with us. You're going to have to deal with us defensively. We're going to get after it. We're going to make it hard on you. We have multiple, and boy, do I mean multiple post players who have absolutely zero problem mashing you in the face and hitting you as hard as possible. I will post up, elbow drive, whatever, seal, gonna hit you, whatever. Hey, maybe we don't have three-point shooting. We'll have spacing. We'll get dribble handoffs. A Sonny Citron, fly off screens. Like, we are, like, they are who they are. And because they are who they are, they've beaten the Lynx, they've beaten the Valkyries, and they've beaten the Aces. So I'm intrigued to see how they come out of the All-Star break. But they've put themselves in a position to separate from some of these other teams, to have that eighth spot. And so it's not going to be an easy first-round series no matter what, but it's not going to be an easy first-round series whoever they face. You gotta deal with that size. You got to deal with that length. You got to deal with that defense. You got to deal with them post-ups. So salute to the Mystics. The Young and the Restless have done it again.
The Young and the Restless done it again. And like, I wish I had thought to look this up before the podcast. Because as you mentioned that they've beat the Lynx, they've beaten the Valkyries, they've beaten the Aces. Are they the only team in the league that's beaten all three?
Yes.
Like, it feels like yes. I'm just like, I should have looked that up to confirm that. But like, that's not an easy thing to do. And so that full salute to the Washington Mystics. I'm excited to watch more of them. Also curious to see like how they handle this roster, as I think the trade deadline is on Sunday. Do they look at what they've done so far and be like, actually, we can just add to this and we can make a push right now? Or do you just kind of let this young group continue to coalesce and evaluate things in the offseason?
Absolutely not. they have a nickname for a reason. You let them figure it out.
You know what? That is probably fair. I'm fascinated by the Washington Mystics. While we're here, though, we can stay in the Eastern Conference. Mentioned this maybe two pods ago. The Indiana Fever, finding it, winning games, putting a whole lot of points on the board. They have the best offensive rating in WNBA history right now, Steve. In fact, three of the top five offenses in WNBA history in terms of offensive rating are playing basketball this year. It's the 26th Fever at one, it's the 26th Aces at two. And, you know, we kicked things off pretty early with the Minnesota Lynx. They are currently at five, and they just added Nafisa Collier, which is kind of nuts. So, wanted to have that on wax, that we are seeing historic offense, period, but with the Indiana Fever in particular. And this is with Leah Boston's missed a little bit of time. Caitlin Clark's been in and out of the lineup. She's had the minutes restriction and things like that. And they are still pretty firmly the best offense in W history in terms of just the raw offensive rating. Now, another thing that I wanted to look at, Steve, was the relative offensive rating. How much better is this team compared to what the league average was that year? Just to add a little bit more context to make it easier to compare across eras. And the Indiana Fever, just outside the top 10 in terms of the best offensive rate, best offenses of all time. The 2019 Mystics, just a little bit of brand synergy there since we just finished talking about Washington. Best relative offense of all time. nearly 15 points better than league average in 2019. The 23 Aces, nearly 11 points better than league average in 2023. Those are the only two teams with a plus 10 or better. And so we will see where the Indiana Fever ultimately land. But I just want to continue to watch this offense. I think as Caitlin Clark stays healthy and gets more comfortable, the minutes uptick, you see the drive, the playmaking, shot-making blend. Kelsey Mitchell has not stopped getting buckets. Aaliyah Boston can do pretty much whatever you ask her to. Low post touches, elbow touches. I can be in the ball to break hub. I can pick and roll. I can pick and pop. I can bring the ball up. I can initiate. Those three together just continues to put defenses in a headlock. And the pace that they play at continues to put teams on their back foot early, in addition to the actions that they run. And so I want to see like where the offense lands. Do they just hold firm with this and become the best offense ever? And then the conversation that we had the other day is just like, okay, how consistently can you hit a level defensively to make that pop? If for the rest of the year they're like the sixth or seventh best defense, that isn't great, but that's solid. If you pair that with the best offense ever, it'd be time to talk about them more seriously as like legit title contenders. If that's what their formula is, all-time offense, solid enough defense. And so like, I'm just curious to see like, will the Fever make history and just how balanced would this group be moving forward?
To add to your point, this Wings Fever dream, 4-5-6 mm-hmm. deal, who emerges, who separates? Because the Wings, in theory, are knocking on the Aces' door, standings-wise. They're only mm-hmm. a half game back. The Fever have surged up into a different position. The Dream, hot start, hasn't been the most fun 10 games before going to the break, but that's with them winning three straight games going into the break. So, which of these teams are kind of gonna establish themselves going into it? And I think that's where it gets really interesting. I think you probably trust the Lynx. You probably trust the Aces. The Valkyries, can't deny them. They have just said, I really don't care what you think. Going to defend, going to shoot threes, going to drive. We're going to go. So between the Wings, Fever, and Dream, who takes the good of what they've done at the start of this season and establishes that throughout? So I'm intrigued to see that play out. Because I'm telling you, folks, these playoffs are going to be insanely tough. These matchups are going mm-hmm. to be absolutely difficult. Some very good teams are going to have to play other very good teams. And like, that's the fun of the W, the most competitive league in sports. So I can't wait to see how that develops. Do you have any other final second half storylines, Nikias?
Yes, I'll go rapid fire with some thoughts. I will say, one, just from a health perspective, like, can we see the full New York Liberty group? And tied to that, if they are able to get healthy, can they have a second half push? Or is this just going to be more of the inconsistent match that we've seen with them? So I'm curious to see what happens with the New York Liberty on that front. On the award front, two in particular intrigue me. One, I don't know what's going to happen with Defensive Player of the Year right now. This is why we have the second half surge. So I'm curious to see what that part's going to look like. Is this going to be Asia Wilson, who has the ridiculous on-off splits and has the box score stuff? Is it going to be Gabby Williams or a Valkyries rep in general? Do we see Sonya Citron's name pop up a little bit more for what she's doing at the head, as the head of the snake of Washington's defense? That's a fascinating race to me. And then the all-rookie team, Steve. Mm-hmm. I think Olivia Miles is naturally going to be there. AZ Fudd is going to be there. Mm-hmm. And then after that, or those are the two players that I think they're going to be on 100% of ballots at the very least. After that, I feel like it's like five names for three spots, which I'm kind of intrigued by.
I think you can get a strong pencil and put two more in there. I think
that just be the storm.
I think you'll see Fajay Johnson and Alifam on those teams. Mm-hmm. I think those four players will be there. Now, number five, does Kiki Rice come back? Does Gabriella Hawkins, friend of the show, come back and continue to move on? Do we see our Raven Johnson or Cody McMahon run? I'm not sure. What do you think?
I guess in addition to those names, like Pauline Astier has been pretty darn good from New York for, I would say, about 85-90% of the season. So that's a shout. Not a ton of bright spots in Chicago with all the injury stuff that they've had to deal with this year, but Sidney Taylor has gotten all of the buckets. And so that's where I'm just like, hey, the second half of the season, it can get kind of interesting for those final spots. And like, depending on what the voters prioritize, like, are you producing on a playoff team? Are you soaking up usage in a way that you weren't anticipating? Whatever the priorities are, I think that can also kind of shapeshift to who's going to get favored to kind of close out that team. But I think rookie of the year, again, I think that's going to be Olivia Miles. Or if AZ Foot makes a ridiculous run in the second half on a playoff team as well, we'll see what the conversation is there. But all rookie team, just keep an eye on them because we got some interesting players.
It might be Cindy Taylor. It might be Cindy Taylor. I might write all five and call it a day. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. That's going to do it for me. One last thing I wanted to bring up before we close out the show. As head All-Star Weekend, Steve and I, on a separate video, we drafted our own All-Star teams. That video is out. Got some comments, no voting teams, et cetera. We said that we're going to do a 2K sim with our drafted teams. We had two simulations go through. Team Nikias was able to get it done.
And yeah, shout out to Nikias. He won. Good job. You did a good job. I lost. Well done, Nikias. You won by 20 and 25. Good job. Salute. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dunker Spot. we will join you at a different date and talk about different things. Really appreciate y'all, Dunkers. You can find us anywhere that you find your podcast platform. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports NBA YouTube channel and the Yahoo Sports channel. Hit that link. Hit that like button. Hit that subscribe. We get notifications. You can find him on socials at Nikias NBA. You can find me on socials at Steve Jones 20. And with that, we say thank you very much. Have a wonderful rest of your day.